It's Wednesday, April 28th, 2010, and you're listening to episode 189 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 48 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Pat.
I'm still Wayne.
And this is Chris.
We are Chadless because he's off taking care of his monthly activity.
His monthly visitor.
Yep. He's off seeing his Aunt Flo, by which I mean he's at his board game meetup, which one of these days he said he wants to talk about on the show, talk about what goes on there and how other people can get involved and stuff like that, which I'd be interested to hear.
Really? Would you? Really?
I would.
I hear about it all the time. And I mean, I go to these things, but I go to them on weekends. So
it sounds like some sort of mysterious cabal.
I'm sure of that. They probably have some kind of like pink string they tie around their wrists or something.
And they all wear like Nike Cortez sneakers and shave their heads bald.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, I'm just getting a picture of Craig as Doe, I guess. Or Craig, I mean Chad.
I wasn't sure. I was
blurring it all together. I was started getting all sucked in here.
Do you ever have your kids walk into the room and you don't remember who they are?
Let me tell you something.
All the time.
I don't suffer from that, but Julie, God love her, she does. Fortunately, we only have 4 kids and 2 of each gender, so she's got a 50-50 chance of getting the name right gender-wise. I've come to believe that it's genetic because her dad, he's been that way for years. And the thing is that he has grandkids and son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws to go through, so he has this library of names that he usually goes through before he gets the right one.
Does he ever like mistakenly ask if one of them's still in the Navy or something like?
No, he's pretty coherent when as far as all that stuff goes. He's actually still very sharp, a great guy. But when it comes to the names things,
sounds like he's got one thing on Chris then.
No, you know, speaking of that though, there was one guy who was a friend of his who always got my name wrong, and I made the mistake of not correcting him the first couple times it happened. So until the guy died, he thought my name was Craig. I mean, and even when my mother-in-law said to him...
And now you're paying that forward?
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, that's why I'm calling Chad Craig. But even when my mother-in-law, she finally said to him one day, she said, "It's Chris!" 2 minutes later, he said, "All right, I'll see you later, Craig." You know? It's one of those faux pas. It's like, you know, you're having a good conversation. You don't want to have... You don't want to say, "Oops, sorry, no, it's Chris." You know, it's just, I don't know.
I never had that problem. I always just bluntly say it.
I feel bad even saying this, but this is just a moment of transparency on my part. We talked to Fred Hicks about being a transparent company. So here's being a transparent podcaster. I have a grandma whose mind is completely gone, but physically speaking, she is just as healthy as a horse. I mean, she's half Chris's age, so I think she's approaching 90.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Spring chicken
to Chris. Yeah. That'd be robbing the cradle as far as he's concerned. But she's just out of her mind. And man, this would have been over 10 years ago. I guess 13 years ago now. If I was able to just put a year to that. 13 years ago, I was dating a girl who had 2 young kids. One was 3 and one was 4. And she was just convinced that they were mine, that they were her grandkids. And mind you, this woman lives here in the area, and we see her all the time. It's not like I go years between seeing this woman. And it's like, don't you think you would have noticed at some point me impregnating this girl would have been 5 years ago?
You think she would have been... Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben.
I don't know how you do things in your family, but...
everywhere is the Roper household.
Okay,
so.
Okay.
No. Don't you think you would have noticed at some point this girl being pregnant and then a kid being born and at some point along these 5 years? And at this point in time, she is now, but at that point in time, she was not so out of her mind as to explain that kind of flub. It's not like she had advanced Alzheimer's disease or something like that.
My dad, and this was just one of his personality quirks, he actually never, or rarely, if ever, called us by our given names. He developed nicknames for all of us. And, you know, it's that whole Bill Cosby thing where he's like, you know, Dad, I thought I was Jesus Christ.
I was just about to go down that path.
Yeah, that's exactly.
I'm sure you were goddamn it, though.
I don't know. My dad, he's a strange individual. I was always Al. My older sister, Lynn, her name was always Fred. He just had his ways of doing things and having names for people. And I mean, for the longest time, honestly.
How did you become Al?
I have no idea. That's the thing. I didn't do anything to garner that name. That was just what was it going through his head at the time that he was going to, that I was walking across the room and he wanted me to get in the remote for the TV. I don't know.
I don't think Al's as bad as the fact that his sister became Fred.
Yeah. It's just very, you know, it's one of those strange things. And my sister Colleen, everybody called her Beanie because it came from, they just called her Colleen the Bean. But when I was growing up, everyone was calling her Beanie. So I didn't even realize until I was like, almost 10, that her name was actually Colleen. In fact, when they would call her that, I would be like looking around like, who are you talking to?
That's funny.
You know, I've got an uncle like that. His nickname is Tuffy. And I didn't know until I was about 15 that his real name was Glenn, because that's all anybody ever called him.
Strange things. Actually, you know, speaking of that, to get away from people's names for a minute, I was having this a naming conversation with some people. Now, let me ask you, as far as St. Louis goes, are you guys casserole or are you guys hot dish?
Casserole.
Okay. See, in Minnesota, it's hot dish. In fact, it's so hot dish in northern Minnesota as far as what that type of dish is called that...
Are we talking about strip joints?
No. We're talking about food.
No,
we're
it's
about
a food. Particular but, move that you have to pay about $300 for, though.
I can give you a hot dish. Actually, I can tell you. Anyway, I won't go there either, but I got a couple stories on that. But,
that's right. I'll go there all night.
Wait a second. But we were having this conversation at work about things being casserole, and I was talking to him about in Minnesota, the word hot dish is so ingrained, at least in northern Minnesota, that honestly, until I was a teenager, I thought a casserole was something completely different as far as what goes in it. Just because everybody everywhere was hot dish. You'd go to the little Lutheran church, you know, potlucks, and everybody bring a hot dish. Nobody ever brought a casserole. What the hell's a casserole? You bring a hot dish.
I was thinking when you said hot dish. I've never heard that word before.
I actually hadn't either. I'd never heard hot dish.
You guys have never heard of hot dish?
No, not until now.
I've heard the soda pop Coke debate 100 times over, but I have never seen a demographic breakdown of the U.S. by hot dish and casserole. This one is.
I'm wondering if there are other terms.
You know, it's your meat, your pasta, and your cream of soup, you know, and however you blend that together. Yeah, northern Minnesota, seriously, from like, it's not so much the Twin City area, but it's north of that. It's hot dish. And then, yeah, I guess everywhere else in the country, apparently, it's casserole. So,
Pat, you're wondering if there's other words. I'm just wondering if Chris has finally gone senile.
Oh, what do you mean finally gone? He's way off that deep end. So it's got cheese, though, too, right? So what's your favorite hot dish here, Chris?
Oh, man, that's a really good question. I've never liked tuna casserole or tuna hot dish. I think most of
See, I knew that about you, Chris.
Wow. But that doesn't
mean... I don't like tuna casserole.
This goes back to our previous recording attempt when we were talking about feminine hygiene products, I guess. Yeah. But
this is why you have four kids.
Yeah.
I thought I went back to the sexting between Pat and Chris here.
Yeah.
It probably would be tater tot hot dish. It's got your macaroni noodles. It's got beef, and it's got, of course, corn, cream of soup, most of the time cream of chicken or cream of mushroom. Of course, you top it off with tater tots and you bake it in the oven. I haven't had that in years, but it's a northern Minnesota comfort food.
Where the hell's the cheese? Surely there's cheese, right?
You know what?
This is Minnesota we're talking about. I mean, it's not Wisconsin, certainly, but it's the Land of Lakes. Oh, so it's butter, isn't it?
Well, you put a lot of butter in instead. There is actually a good... usually have it with white bread
two
and butter.
Or three sticks of butter, eh?
Yeah.
No cheese, though? Seriously, no cheese?
In that one, there is no cheese. There is a... technically wouldn't be a hot dish, I guess. I think that's
the difference between that and a casserole. I think casseroles have to have cheese in them.
Maybe you can get a dwarf to stand over there and put cheese over it.
That's true.
Dwarves. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
This is fascinating. Dwarves.
Pulling away from this brilliance.
What are you talking about? This is good stuff.
Two announcements. First off, we've got some late signups and also doing some interview episodes. We haven't done the announcements at all for two shows. So we are delaying the start of the Blood Bowl League by 2 weeks. We have enough for the Steam League. The 361, I got to be honest, I don't think is going to happen. But who knows? Maybe a bunch of people come out last minute and sign up for it. The Steam one, we got enough people for. But we are going to give you guys 2 more weeks to get in there and get signed up. So you now have through noon Central Time on May 6th. To get signed up, and the league will start with whoever's in there on May 9th. So we've pushed it back by 2 weeks. Second thing, Fear the Boot is trying a little bit of an experiment. There's another podcast out there by the name of Postcards from the Dungeon, which was just started up a little while back by two guys that have been longtime listeners and longtime forum users, which is Steven, who goes by Runestar on the forums, and Michael, who goes by Michael on the forums. And both of them been on our forums. Both of them, I believe, have posted blog posts, and Michael was one of the guys on our roundtable about LARPing. And they started up the show, and later they added a third host by the name of Jim to it. And what the show is about is drawing creative inspiration from other sources of entertainment. So looking at books, TV, movies, whatever, finding plot ideas, finding character ideas, just finding any form of inspiration you can, or any framework you can take away that you can apply to a role-playing game. So it's looking at entertainment in the light of a role-playing game. It's kind of a neat idea. It's a well-put-together show. I've enjoyed it. You know, obviously,
I really geeked out when I saw they were talking about something as obscure as a Dyson sphere.
Yeah, so this is total, I mean, obviously, like all podcasts, it's a cook-to-taste sort of thing. But in the past, someone had asked me before why we never tried to start a network out of our own. And the answer is, well, nobody's really ever approached us. And so he said, consider this someone approaching you. Would you be interested in forming some kind of a network or partnership with us? And I said, you know what? What the hell? Let's try it. So where is this heading? I have no idea. All I can tell you is right now, we are just trying it out with one show to see what happens, to see if there's any ability here for us to collaborate on things, or I don't even know what. But you are going to start noticing a sub forum for their show on our forum, and possibly some joint creative endeavors in the future. I really have no idea where this is going to go. But if you see some stuff about our show pop up over there, or some stuff from their show popping up on our forums or whatnot, that's an explanation of what's going on. In the meantime, it's a good show. It's well put together. It's run by a bunch of great guys. I'd suggest, hey, at least go check it out. Worst you're going to do is give up an hour of your life trying out one of their shows. So there you go, and there you are. Chris?
Yes.
There's something controversial you want to say. It may annoy a lot of people. So before you do that, I'm going to give you a chance to endear yourself to all the youngins out there, the 80 and under crowd. There's a story you were telling us right before we were recording about you and the sprinkler.
We could also, as Wayne had said, call this the money shot story.
Yes. And this is the reason why Fear the Boot will never have office space. And if it does, it will never have nice things.
This is why we don't have nice things. Basically, it happened about 2 years ago, and Julie and I had gone in on Labor Day weekend to do some, I was doing some renovations in my office, moving some furniture. And the building that the station is in is a very old, historic building. And on the mezzanine level where I am, there's pipework and sprinkler heads that are hanging down. So I don't have a false ceiling on my floor with little tiny sprinkler heads. I got pipes with heads. And it's all kind of lower than normal. So we were in the process of moving this file cabinet, which was about a 6-foot-tall file cabinet, and I had positioned it in the hallway and had gotten my two-wheeler, and the plan was simply to prop it up and haul it down this hallway to a much more open space because I was getting rid of it. Well, thinking like Khan in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, I was only thinking two-dimensionally and not necessarily paying much attention to the extra height that would be generated when I lifted this thing up. So I counted to three, and I lifted it up, and the next thing I know, I'm getting blasted in the face with a bunch of water. And
just that phrase right there, I counted to three, lifted it up, and next thing I know, I'm getting blasted in the face.
And really, we should just leave the story there because it just becomes a sad tale at this point. But I let out a very, very long fuck, and then proceeded to make sure Julie was okay because, of course, water is spraying everywhere, and the fire alarm has now gone off in the building. And I run downstairs and tell the newsroom that's right below me that there is no fire, the sprinkler head's broken, we got to shut the water off, and then promptly go run downstairs into the boiler room looking for the magic water shutoff valve. And I have absolutely no idea what I'm looking for, but I run around down there like an idiot for a couple of minutes, come back up, and the fire department, thankfully, has arrived, and there's fire trucks outside there, and there's sirens going off. And as I get back up in the newsroom, I see that the water now from above has started leaking down through their false ceiling. And water is falling everywhere on their computers and the carpeting and getting everything wet. The feelings of idiocy are really starting to sink in deep right about now. So I run back upstairs, and thankfully the fire department had capped off the sprinkler head. But the damage had been done, and there was a good 1.5 to 2 inches of water already floating all over the floor of my department area.
Wow.
And water had been sprayed on TVs in my area and computer monitors and editing systems and tape decks. All of these wonderful things are now soaked in water.
How much of it was ruined?
You know, surprisingly, Not much. I mean, the TV got trashed. Some furniture definitely took some water damage. But the editing systems all survived, which was amazing. And by the time everything just started to slowly settle down, and I had already talked to my boss and explained things to her, I finally had a chance to go into the bathroom, try and compose myself. And somebody said to me, you should go clean yourself up. And I knew my shirt was dirty because I had a white shirt on and it was, of course, soaked, but it was also very brown. And so I knew
the real question
was,
did Julie have a white shirt on too?
She did not, and she was spared because the file cabinet had cut off the water from shooting on her and pushed it all towards me. And so
Chris avoided getting it on his wife.
Yeah.
Yes, I did. So I go in the bathroom, and I finally take a look at myself, and I really, honestly, I look like Al Jolson. And because, I mean, as pasty of a white guy as I am, my face was just completely brown. I mean, I really had inadvertently put on blackface, and it was just, except for my eyes, of course, because my glasses were there. And so I had these big white sockets.
Oh, Chris, only you can get away
and so,
with that.
He's from a different generation.
He is. Yeah. He's grandfathered in.
Yeah.
It's okay for him to talk about blackface.
Yeah. Back in my day, blackface was fine.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So, no, my face was completely dirty. I went to the clinic, got a tetanus shot, and cleaned myself up, and fortunately remained employed after all this was done. Although me and my staff had to spend the next, like, 2 or 3 months in a conference room with all of our editing systems and everything, you know, crammed on this one table, where we basically sat maybe 2 feet from each other with no dividers for quite a long time. That's the money shot story.
But you got to know each other really well, and you probably had some hot dish potlucks while you were in there, too.
We had a couple hot dish potlucks at the station.
It was all right.
It ended up, the whole incident ended up becoming dubbed Hurricane Hussy because of the sheer amount of water that was thrown around there.
Have you gotten Julie to start calling you that now, too?
No, thankfully, she does not. You know, and one thing about this, too, the ceiling on the mezzanine floor where I'm at, it was a textured ceiling, so it's all, like, kind of stucco-ish up there. It's all, you know, it's not flat. It's all very textured. The water pressure that came out was so strong, it stripped off the texturing from the radius surrounding that sprinkler head. I mean, just ripped it right off.
Wow.
I mean, it was really... I'll try and take a picture of it so you can have it for the show. And that, of course, is what hit me in the face. And thank goodness I had my glasses on, actually, because I probably would have taken some damage to my eyes because you don't want to get it in your eyes. It just stinks.
So now that we've heard about how you destroyed your office, let's see how you're going to destroy your reputation on the forums.
And now I'm going to destroy everybody's opinion of me and the gaming industry.
So to set this one up, at Gen Con 2009, which I did not attend, I'm probably going to be at 2010. And also for anyone that's curious, we will be doing the Toft Bitch thing again at Gen Con 2010. And for anyone that has no idea what a Toft Bitch is because you're new to the show or whatnot, it's an abbreviation of the official Fear the Boot communications hub. If you write that out, it looks kind of like Toft Bitch. And what this is a group of guys where basically you can give them a cell phone number. And during the con, we will be running impromptu get-togethers to eat sushi, to play pickup games, whatever. And they will just blast out a message. And it creates sort of this con within a con or sort of a subculture. And I hear it was a huge success last year.
It worked very well last
year. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, a lot of people got involved and had a really good time. So we are going to try that again this year. But while I was not there, Chris had this rollicking debate with someone who is involved in the indie RPG scene. And I want to say it was someone from IPR, but I could be completely wrong because I was not there. And this was one of the interviews that was not videotaped. It was an audio interview. And something went wrong with the mic cable, or I don't know what, but it brutalized a whole slew of interviews that got lost, which is one of the reasons why it's coming here. We're just going to stick to video interviews. But I don't know who Chris was debating, and Chris and Chad cannot recall who they were debating.
It's very unfortunate because it was a good debate, and he had numerous good opinions and arguments.
Well, and that's why the main thing I want to do here is this, is we were going to set the topic up with the hopes of coming back later to develop this better, hopefully with the person that Chris had this debate with. So if you are that person or know who that person was and can get in contact with us, shoot an email to wayne@feartheboot.com so he can set that interview up. But in the meantime, we are going to at least set up what the topic was. And Chris, when we were kicking this around, one of my concerns was this is something that really geeks never do. It's just this pointless semantic debate, which I have never before heard our culture engage in.
No, never. You
know, we seem to be very resistant to this kind of thing. So I didn't want to fear the boot to kind of, you know, pee in the pool, so to speak, and change that. But the question is, or was, what exactly does it mean to be an indie game developer or an indie game? And your response to this was an interesting one, which was not per se to nitpick the definition, but to say you don't think such a thing exists at all. I'd love to hear you explain that.
Yeah, I don't really think that the term, you know, oh, this is an indie game, I don't think that means what you think it means, is basically kind of where I'm coming from. And I compare
it to...
That's
very Lewis Carroll of you.
You like that?
I was thinking
more Princess Bride, but hey. I compare this all to the movie industry in the sense that in the movie industry, you have multiple large major studios, and formulaically, they all kind of produce the same thing. Yes, everything's a movie, but as far as how that all goes together, there's usually a good-sized star. There certainly is a good-sized budget. The movie itself follows a predictable plot. You know, 8 times out of 10, what you're going to get from a major studio is going to be similar to what you get from another major studio. The independent film industry is not necessarily that way. It is definitely a labor of love. Budgets are always small. Certainly, there's not necessarily a lot of stars attached to it unless they're feeling that they need to stretch their creative wings. It just doesn't quite fit the same mold. It certainly doesn't have the distribution reach as major movie studios. When you compare that to the gaming industry, it doesn't, because in the sense that the gaming industry is so small... With the exception, we'll accept out Wizard of the Coast, because indeed, they are large, and they certainly have plenty of reach, and they certainly have plenty of name recognition. But everybody else doesn't have that same level of name recognition, or that same level of reach, or certainly that same level of devoted followers, or people who are going to pick up that. So in other words, everybody ends up becoming indie, which of course then means that nobody is really indie. Game mechanics are game mechanics, whether you're using lots of dice, or just a few dice, or no dice, and I don't think that saying that a game is indie because of the mechanics or because of the setting makes it indie. And size-wise, it doesn't really matter because companies ain't that big. They're too small to be indie.
There are two objections that were stated to your point, at least amongst us. And Wayne had a good one, and I think his is actually probably more substantive than mine, which is why I want to hit his second and get mine out of the way. The first thing that crossed my mind is this maybe just, it's all relative. Okay, granted, the biggest RPG company is smaller than the biggest movie company. And probably even the average RPG company is a whole lot smaller than the average movie house or television house or record company or whatever particular creative media you want to employ here. But certainly there are still levels of size and levels of market penetration to where I think you could still create sort of a relative gradient here, that even if there's not as big of a difference between, let's say, some guy sitting at home, labor of love, putting out a PDF versus, I don't know, we'll just say Mongoose or Green Ronin or whatever, that even if the difference between those two is not as great as the difference between some guy putting out his $500 film at Sundance versus Avatar, isn't there still enough difference between them, culturally speaking, to create sort of a relative difference?
Yeah, but what makes that difference, though? I mean, so I write a game about samurai cowboys from space, and Mongoose writes a game about samurai cowboys from the ocean. I mean, really, besides the fact of the setting, what's the difference? So what makes mine indie except for the fact that I did it as opposed to Mongoose doing it?
That is what makes it indie, Chris. And that's my problem with the way you're stating this, is that you're giving attributes to indie that aren't there natively. Indie is independent. That means that you are not beholden to a company. You are not beholden to a license owner. You're creating your product and putting it out there. Your product could be just like every other product out there. You could release something that's just like Dungeons & Dragons, something that's just like Savage Worlds, like Mouse Guard, doesn't matter. The content and the product itself do not in any way make you indie. You not being beholden to a company or to a license owner. My personal opinion is that anything that's a licensed property can never be indie because you're beholden to the license owner.
A great example you gave of that
Mouseguard.
It was Mouseguard.
Mouseguard was a comic book first. It is a licensed property. It is touted as this great indie achievement, but in my opinion, it's not indie. They're beholden to the license owner.
Whether it's me personally that's designing the game, or whether it's me and my two buddies that have decided to form a company and design a game between the three of us, and we all agree on creatively how this is going to come out, to me, that functionally, that's no different, because the three of us decided to do it as opposed to the one of us decided to do it. And we, any disagreements we had were smoothed out, and we all are in love and agree on the final product that was put. The, functionally, there's no difference.
I have a little bit of a problem with your analogy in using the movie companies and saying that the difference with a mainstream movie and an independent movie. I think what you're missing, though, is that in essence, at the end of the day, they're all putting out a movie. The mainstream movie may have a bigger budget and have a lot of special effects, and the indie doesn't. It's just, but they're both still telling a story, and it's a movie. It's a visual experience. And I think the same thing is true with games. Your big companies are putting out a game, that your indie groups, they're also still putting out a game. So, I mean, I think you're sort of getting at the point of that the big movie houses are putting out blockbusters that appeal to the masses, and the independent guys are doing these, what I want to call an art house flick that appeals to Chad, and you know, and that's, I think that's the difference you're hitting on,
and
you're trying to say that, and that it's coming through in the game that, well, you have to make this game has to be some avant-garde thing that only appeals to a subset of the culture, and I don't think that is necessarily the case of what it really means to be an independent whatever.
Well, but see, that's kind of my point, is the fact that all of these games that are put out by all of these little companies, or even some of the big companies, they all have just their own select following. I don't think that there really is, again, accepting D&D to a certain extent, there really is no mass market appeal thing. There's all these little clans of people who follow around. Oh, I just play Rifts. I just play Battletech. I just play Mouseguard.
I got you, but I don't think stripping away Wizards of the Coast is the way to look at that analogy, because, like Dana said, it's a matter of scale. I think you can do the same thing with movies. If you were to take the top five movie studios away, and then maybe that next tier of the smaller, you know, movie studios away, then you've got the same thing in the movie industry. You've got the small art house people and the more independent people that are making movies. And that's exactly what you said about, you know, taking away Wizards of the Coast and maybe like the second tier of the big ones. And then you get to matter
comic
scale.
Comic books and movies.
Sure.
Comic books and music too.
Well, and this is where we get into the semantic debate that I'm trying to avoid.
Okay.
But if we ever fully develop this topic, maybe a necessary bridge to cross, which is indie is one of those culturally emergent terms. The word independent has a dictionary definition, but the way that it's applied culturally does not necessarily fit the dictionary definition. Yeah. And I've seen it used three different ways. One is to mean that simply something is small. If you're small in budget or small in production or small in market penetration, that makes you indie. Mm-hmm. The second is to be experimental. If you're weird, which is in the process of being weird, going to limit your market penetration and such, you're independent. The third is to be corporately independent, which is what Wayne said. And by corporately independent, I don't mean corporate as business. I mean corporate as in the literal meaning of the word. You are a separate body, that there is no person or organization that you are beholden to. And it strikes me that some of this is a disagreement over which of these we mean by an independent game. For example, what we would call, I think, as a hobby, the indie game market or indie game publishers, you know, the guys doing the labors of love on PDFs to put on drive-thru, a lot of that has been taken up over the past several years by a huge number of D20 products. Well, D20 came out of D&D and Wizards of the Coast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so here's certainly stuff that, at least in terms of system, is not experimental, is not per se corporately independent, because they were bound by the OGL. Now, granted, the OGL was pretty forgiving, but they were still bound by the OGL. And at one point, while they never repealed the OGL, they did take back the D20 portion of it. You can't have a D20 product anymore or whatnot. You were still beholden to something. So even though it was a labor of love that had a print run of you, your mom, and three friends, it was still, in other senses of the word, not at all indie. Mm. And I would love to hear how this other guy defended his take on the indie market and how much of that was objective reality versus, once again, his subjective take on this emergent word.
And I think that forum users, too, have an incredible amount of opinions on this as well, and I think that they would bring up some of the stuff that we necessarily haven't talked about because, I mean, they're all gamers. They like to wank just as much as the rest of us. Am I right, Pat, or am I right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What? So yeah, I think it's almost good in a certain way to kind of leave this hanging. You know, let's bring in some of that stuff, and then, yeah, if he's out there... Damn it, I wish I could remember the guy's name. And he called and we got in contact and we did set up a roundtable. I think it would be actually a worthwhile discussion to have.
I think the one point where it starts to require definition, and this is something we were kicking around before, is when it becomes either a badge of honor or a mark of derision. That once we take it, and it's no longer just a descriptive term, but is now a value term, that it's now... Oh, I like this because it's independent, or I don't like it because it's independent, that now suddenly the word begs for a definition. I don't know. Once again, if you're out there or you're out there and know who it is we were referring to, then send an email to wayne@feartheboot.com and we can try and reset this up and explore this topic in more detail and give him a chance to swing back. But in the meantime, let's just leave this one as it is and we will hopefully come back to it soon.
And I'm not saying that I can't be convinced one way or t'other. It's just, you know, that's just kind of how I feel about that particular issue right now.
So our main topic that we're going to talk about today is something that we have hit from the other side quite a few times. Nothing on that, Pat? Nothing at all?
No. Sorry. I had the Offspring hit that song in my head, yeah.
But we've talked about the other side quite a few times, which is how a GM ought to keep the players involved, keep them invested in the setting, keep them invested in their characters, how players themselves ought to work to keep themselves invested in the setting and their characters. But we've not talked a lot about the reverse of that, at least not as an organized subject, which is what do the players need to do to keep the GM invested in the game? Because the fact is, the game master, just like the players, has his ups and downs, has weeks he's interested in it, has weeks he's not, needs some kind of motivation to keep going, and probably doubly so because, number one, they have to produce all the content. They carry the lion's share of the work compared to the players, at least in most games. And number two, they are the font from which at least the beginning of the game springs. And if that well dries up, unless you're playing a total sandbox game or a pass-the-stick sort of game, which most people aren't, then there is no game beyond this. If the game master has no more plot or has no more desire to ref the game and to be the NPCs, the game stops. It doesn't move forward. And so let's talk about some things that the players can and should do to keep the game master invested in this endeavor.
Stroke his ego.
What do you mean exactly by that? I mean, because saying, hey, great game tonight is one thing, but saying, hey, you know, I really enjoyed the part where we did this with Baron von Badass and we fought, you know, these Nazi zombie bugbears and they did this thing. That's another thing completely, because I think offhanded compliments, you know, like, hey, good game, they only go so far, and it's almost like it's like saying thank you. You just kind of have to do that. But really taking that time to be specific about something has a bigger impact on a GM as far as what they did, because then it's a topic they can latch onto and pursue.
Chris, I will even say, though, that even just the, hey, it was a good game, is at least a good place to start. You know, because a lot of people don't even do that, because you're saying that's just like you have to do that, like saying thank you. Well, you should be amazed at how many people out there have no manners and they don't say please and thank you in the first place. So, you know, even the small gestures, I think, will go a long way.
Yeah, it's all about communication. You have to tell them what you like, how you like it, what hurts, what's a little to the left.
To play off of everybody but Wayne, I will say that as a game master, genuine positive feedback is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Because game masters, like all human beings, are going to keep coming back to things they have a positive association with. You know, that positive feedback energizes them, keeps them going. But there has to be a sense it's genuine. And I will completely agree with what Chris said, that saying, hey, good game. Yeah, okay, that's a good start. And Pat, to your point, yes, there are a lot of people out there that don't have basic manners, so would not even say that. But I think as a game master, it's very hard to lock onto that. It's really easy to say they're just being polite, or maybe they did enjoy the game. But it doesn't start to feel real until they start saying, wow, this one scene totally blew me away. Or I see them energized to talking amongst themselves about it or having email conversations about it. And so I would say that absolutely the players choosing to be invested in the game, to be energized about it themselves, they have to remember there is a cultural gestalt going on around the table, just as players, by their behavior and example, can bring up or bring down other players. The players as a group can bring up or bring down the GM by choosing to contain an energy level or an enthusiasm or gratitude that is genuine and believable.
I was thinking about that in, you know, just in some of the things that can happen around the game. I would say as a player, try not to be really reserved. What I mean by that is if something really cool happens in the game, express that enthusiasm. They, you know, just go off and like, oh my God, that was awesome.
Get excited,
you know,
and
really get into it. Or even within the role playing of the game, like I think our last session was a good example of this. We started playing and seeing how things were going. I was taking things along a more serious tack. And then Chad just sort of came out of left. I mean, way out of left field, just did wacky, wild, crazy stuff.
Which is where he lives, by the way, way out in left field.
Oh, yeah. And at first I was a little reticent to go with the flow of it. But then I something just sort of clicked and I'm like, okay, I'll see you and raise you 20. And so, you know, I just sort of went with it. And I think that kind of a thing, I think we all enjoyed it. I think it sort of it made the situation kind of fun, wacky, wild, kooky. And, you know, just in that, so getting into the playing of it can actually, I think, go a long way, too, to show, you know, everybody's enjoying it. The GM has got something going here, and obviously the players are enjoying it, so that can be their...
You know, something I've noticed...
From my perspective, that's huge. That's huge, is that yeah, players may not necessarily talk to me about things after the session's over, but if I see them as players really getting into what's happening and really engaging the role-playing that I'm throwing out there and coming back to me with just as much good role-playing and fun having as I'm having, I mean, really getting into it, that's the biggest feedback for me, and that's a big motivator because it makes me want to try and recreate that the following week.
Agreed. During the game itself, be invested, be involved, be proactive with the game, keep up the role-playing, keep up the plot. If the game master's having a slow moment, maybe even a slow night, don't just sit there quietly waiting to be spoon-fed. Jump in, make something up, pick an NPC to go talk to, create a plot point of your own or a personal project for your character. Pick something to jump off on that's going to keep that game going and keep that momentum going, even when the game master is a little bit down. The second point, tied right into what Chris said, is shepherd the other players a little bit. If you see the other players starting to slow down, starting to get off task, becoming annoying, jacking around with their phone, whatever, then don't wait for the game master to take care of the problem. Jump in and take care of it. If somebody's off task, start role-playing with them. If somebody else doesn't have the energy level, then find some way to energize them. I mean, as we said, what Chad did, it kind of seemed out of left field at first. But once he kept going with it, it really added a neat role-playing moment to the game. And to explain what we're talking about, they were on a space station, and Chad, just on his own, said he was going to find the strangest restaurant he could find in this space station and basically started a bet surrounding Pat that his character would not do some very ridiculous things. Yeah. I don't bog us down with the gaming story. Yeah. And at first it was like, what are you doing? But then when he kept going with it, it actually worked out. And it brought something to the game that he did not wait for me to spoon feed. I didn't have an NPC approach you guys and start this little contest up. He went out and started it on his own.
You know, just from listening to this and what we're saying and thinking back at some of the things we talked about in the past, I think that a lot of the things that we've talked about before in regards of how to keep your players invested, I think those things are exactly the things that your players should be doing to keep the GM invested as well. So that advice we've given before, sort of like what we were talking about here, it's a two-way street. It applies both ways.
Just and the biggest advice,
because the GM really, at heart, is a player too.
Yeah, and the biggest advice we always give is communication. And that goes to something I've noticed. And I don't know if every group is like this or not, but I've noticed that among various groups that the people in the group will communicate about the game. They'll talk about it between the game, after the game, before the game. They'll talk about what they're excited about, what they're looking forward to, what they're planning. But they never really do that with the GM. the GM seems to be left out of the conversation. And I don't know if it's just that they see him as an authority figure. Like, he's not part of the fun. He's presenting the fun.
Yes. But I think that's on a subconscious level. I don't think it's a conscious thing. On a subconscious level, absolutely. I think sometimes it may reach the conscious level if they see the GM as an adversary.
Yeah.
We're planning how to beat the bad guy, so we can't involve the game master in that conversation because we want to surprise him with a sucker punch. And if that's the case, I think there's already cultural problems around the table.
Yeah. I really think the GMs are missing out on something by not being part of those conversations because they're not getting that everyone talking about this was really cool. And I think that would do a lot to stroke the GM's ego to keep them motivated to however you want to phrase it. It just seems like they're being left out sometimes.
Well, you know, and with that too, Wayne, it is a display of a level of trust in your game master that he's not going to in turn sucker punch you guys and counter plan on everything that you're, you know, sitting there plotting about when it comes to things like that. He's going to fairly and impartially take what you've got to say based on what his notes might be or what he thinks his NPCs are probably going to do and then make the appropriate reaction. And when you have that level of trust like that, it does. It just kind of breeds more and more success with your gaming sessions because the players certainly now know they can trust the GM in talking about secret things in front of the GM. And likewise, the GM can probably feel a lot more trust towards his players because he's getting from them what he wants to get from them. And he feels the trust from them.
I think another aspect of that, sort of like what you guys are saying, is not necessarily a mistrust of the GM, but oftentimes I can think of times in the past where the players have sat around and specifically what they were talking about is, okay, where do we go from here? Or what do we think is going on? What is it that we need to figure out? And that's the kind of thing that you'd sit around and you talk about. You've got your theories and your hypotheses that you talk about with the players, but you can involve the GM, but the GM's going to be sort of sitting there sort of smiling with his arms crossed going, maybe.
Yeah, that was the next point I had too.
Because, you know, because what I'm saying there is that, well, the GM is kind of limited in what he's going to say, obviously, because he hadn't presented that future part of the story. So you're not going to, you know, be tipping your hand or whatever else like that. Well, so I think in some cases, it's not necessarily that you don't trust the GM. It's just that this is the kind of discussion that it's hard for them to be involved in.
And I liken it to talking to someone who's watched the movie that you want to see or a TV show that you want to see. They have this knowledge and they don't necessarily know what you do and don't know. And in this case, the GM does. But, you know, they don't want to let something slip. So they're a little more guarded, maybe less likely to take part in the conversation. And the players are approaching them knowing that they know everything and that they can't be a part of the entire conversation. I wonder if that adds to some of that.
I think a lot of this also starts before the first game even begins. That if you want to keep your game master involved, then I would highly recommend taking their thoughts seriously on what game you're even going to play. Because if they feel energized to run a particular system or a particular setting, or they've got a plot idea for something, and you send them in another direction to a game they're less interested in or excited about, expect less in return. This would be like trying to grab somebody who's a romance author and asking them to write horror. You're just taking them out of the element that they are best at or feel most energized for. And along those lines, when you're developing your character, show a real interest in the GM's take on the setting. If they prefer a certain kind of character or have a certain idea for the setting, make something that fits in with that. Give them lots of things to work with, lots of plot ideas, unresolved situations in your background, long-lost brothers and unanswered questions and mysteries in your past that invite the game master to get involved with your character and give him lots of ideas to keep the plot moving forward that he knows you're going to be energized about.
I'd suggest in-between game communication as well, an email about the game, an email about, you know, okay, I had this idea for my character. What do you think?
I agree with that, Wayne. I think that, I mean, obviously you engage and work with the GM when it comes to character creation. You've got to get some level of back and forth going on there. But it is a sign of a good player that intentionally creates problems for his character, for his GM to exploit with, again, going back to that trust thing, with the trust that it's all going to still work out, you know, ultimately for the best in the end. And because of that, it goes back to the role-playing thing. When you do provide those character elements, and even almost sometimes set your character up for difficult situations, that's an energizer for a GM because it gives them an opportunity to do something that, and they might be stuck at a particular point in the session or maybe looking for just something to add to that evening's gameplay. And by you sticking your neck out there, it sets a fire under that GM and gives them ideas and things to work with.
Some other real simple kind of one-off pointers I came up with. Don't talk about other games. There is nothing that kills a game faster than moving your enthusiasm to a different game.
The question is, how do you get a GM to not talk about other games when they start talking about other games?
I think if the GM's talking about another game, then just like the players, it may be a sign of waning interest. Mm-hmm. And so I think probably at this point you need to ask the GM why they're talking about other games. And if you as the players are interested in keeping that game going, then you need to find out what it is that's got the game master off task. Or the game master needs to proactively communicate what it is that has him off task. And you guys as a group need to evaluate how salvageable that situation is. But certainly as players, don't be the point where that starts unless you're intentionally trying to kill the game and moved on to something else. But realize that towards talking about another game and getting people excited about something else, there's nothing that moves us around quite as quickly as a new shiny. The other thing was give the game master weeks off. You know, this is someone who's bringing you a lot of free entertainment, investing, depending on their GMing style, potentially a lot of time and energy into running the game. If a game master needs a week off, don't create a huge guilt trip or to-do about that. And I'll say my current group is really good about this, that if I'm just not feeling on a particular week, I don't catch a lot of crap for it. I've had previous groups where I did, where I really felt like there was a lot of pressure to keep the game going. And not only is that not cool on a human-to-human level, but that also starts to create a real negative association with the game. It starts to feel like a burden. It's like going to work. This is something I have to do, not something I'd want to do.
That's very true. Yeah, I can't say much more than that is. That's very true. The last thing you want with your gaming sessions is to become, it's another one of those pain-in-the-ass activities that you've got to go get done because you've all agreed to do this pain-in-the-ass activity.
One final point, I guess, and before we close this out, and this may sound like an idea, it's a little bit silly, but it's just something I'm throwing out there for people to consider. If you have the sort of game where you can't involve the GM in your discussions, and it hasn't occurred to you in the course of playing this game to express any kind of gratitude, then just like anything else, don't hesitate to send them a note. Just drop them an email saying, hey, you know, we know the amount of work you put into the game. We appreciate what you do every week. Keep it going. You know, you're doing a good job. And just do this on your own, unsolicited. I mean, you'd be surprised how much impact that can have on someone and what kind of energy that can give them to bring back to the game, especially if you go beyond that. I mean, I think even a simple thank you note would do a lot, but even more if you go beyond that, as we talked about earlier, to be specific, to talk about the elements of the game that you're enjoying, talk about the things you want to see more of, the things that you want to explore, because not only does that give the game master positive feedback that he's succeeding in certain ways, but it also may help him in writing future games or future plots to know right on top what it is he can latch on to. Because as a game master, I'll tell you right now, for me, there are a few things that suck the energy out of a game faster than writer's block. Not knowing where I'm going with this next, and then being intimidated by what feels like my own inability to come up with the next plot point.
Yeah, because feedback like that, and even if this is just conversational feedback, in a lot of ways, it's unintentional constructive criticism, which, you know, ultimately does help improve your game or a scenario or whatever it is that you're working on.
I guess we'll go ahead and wrap this one up here. Once again, don't forget about the Blood Bowl League. Also, Reyna's Wings is still going on. We'll talk about that a little bit more next week, but you can check previous shows for the links on that. And thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Later, days.
Bye.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2010. Listeners are free to use the show in a non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.